The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Let's talk a little bit about the issue of confidentiality. Looked at one way, patients have a right to know the truth about their health because they have a primary responsibility for their health. But they also have a right to privacy about aspects of their lives which do not directly affect others. And healthcare people have a serious obligation to maintain the kind of confidence that protects the patient's right to privacy. Now, what happens in practical life, and then what about some biblical principles here? Well, in practical life, the question is raised, and I think we've all faced it either from one end or the other of the spectrum. When a patient asks what he or she's got, is the physician always required to answer straight? What about when questioned by others about a patient's condition? And if confidentiality is established, how do you go about it? Are you to protect your confidentiality by lying? What do you do? Well, my sense is that in general, and I can think of very few exceptions to this, the doctor ought to tell the patient as much as is going to be a part of the healing process, or as much as is realistic about the likely prognosis, as is going to help the patient make crucial decisions about his or her life. Now, this is fairly easy in the case of, you know, you're overweight, you really need to eat less sugar and less fat and go on a diet, and there's nothing to protect there and except the pride of the patient. It's a lot harder when a patient may be dying of cancer. And what do you do in that case? My view is that I can think of almost no situation in which a physician should keep from the patient the fact that there's a likelihood, and they never can be infallible on this, that the kind of cancer they have is deadly, and give them all the scenarios and so on. I think it's a very important part of the care of the whole person, so that person can prepare himself for not only the ultimate questions of life, which of course is the basic thing, but how to get his house in order. I know you can think of exceptions. For example, apparently, when Kennedy was shot, they kept the news from his dad, who had, I think, a couple of heart attacks, and they feared that this one would send him away. And if memory serves, I think he read it in a newspaper, but didn't die. But the idea there was that there are some kinds of news which are are so brutal that it might do more harm than good to certain people. But I think on the whole, it's hard to conceive of keeping something true about a person, especially if the person is going to die from them. It's hard to conceive how that could be helpful. As a matter of fact, I have discovered that they sort of know anyway. Several years ago, one of my very close associates' wife died of cancer, and it was very rapid. She came down with terrible stomach pains and so on in the month of May. In the month of June, they operated for cancer all over her abdomen, and it had gotten into her liver. And then she died in the very beginning of September. It was actually, you know, longer than it could have been. But now my dear friend, the husband, had this idea that it was very important for her not to know. And he had this huge campaign going, and he got everybody to promise that they wouldn't tell her. He got the doctor to promise not to tell her. He got me, which was very, I didn't promise, but I decided I would respect him. He got everybody who was going to visit the person to agree not to tell her, or he wouldn't let them visit her. Well, I visited her, I guess within a few weeks of the end, and she kind of knew. Hello, Don.
Hi.
And it was very frustrating because she kept saying, you know, from what I can tell, this is the end, but nobody wants to tell me about it. It was just awful. And I disagreed, you know, heartily with this man because he, in a way, deprived her of the right to prepare herself. Actually, however, as I'm saying, she kind of knew. And so she did, in a sense, prepare herself. It was also an interesting thing going on because what he was really doing, not to be too psychoanalytical, but what he was really doing, I think, was avoiding the problem himself. This is a case where somebody was dying of cancer and her husband wanted no one to tell her. She wanted to keep her from it. There is possibly more justification for keeping the knowledge from others on occasion. There may be reasons to keep the knowledge from others. It may not be the most helpful thing for a small child to learn about the brutality of a disease that's affecting the child's mother or father. It also in certain diseases where you're not dying, there may be reasons to keep the knowledge from others because you know that they will make the wrong thing of it. And there are diseases which are connected with embarrassing things that you're trying to get over. I mean, let's say you're an alcoholic. Not that it's a disease, but it can take on proportions of a disease, of course. There can be terrible problems of cirrhosis and so on. And let's say you've gone in to try and finally get cured, and it's, you've had cold turkey, and you've decided that you're going to make a go of it, and the doctors are helping you and so on. It may not be the most helpful thing for people to hear what's happened to you. They may do the wrong thing with the information. They may think less of you. They may give you a hard time at work. They may put you down for it. On the other hand, very often, a person who's in that condition will want his friends and relatives and so on to know, because that's part of the cure. The old AA adage is, you know, get up and admit that you're a drunk. That's half the cure, so they say. So these are These are very difficult questions. The right of privacy, of course, is one of the sacred virtues of our society, but it is limited. It's also limited by the rights of other persons. And the individual is not totally free to dispose of himself as he will. Patients, for example, may behave in ways which injure themselves or even indirectly injure others. If a patient commits suicide and seeks a way to continue chemical dependency, or here we are back to AIDS again, who are in risk of spreading contagious diseases and so on, need to know that their right to privacy is limited. I had a boy come to me when I was a high school teacher after one of my classes and confess that he had been taking heroin, and it was very hard for him to do. And after this confession, he said, "Please don't tell my parents." And I said, "Well, that's something you can't require of me, first of all, and I don't think it's in your best interest. What I'd like is for you to tell your parents, and I'll be there with you if you'd like." And at first, of course, he hated the idea. I mean, it just was awful. But then he began to see the sense of it, and part of the sense of it, of course, was the fact that he was getting a supply from somebody who was corrupting high school kids. The main thing, of course, was his own cure. So we came to a scheme, and we rehearsed it, and we did some role play, and we brought the parents in, and it was hard, but he did it, and the parents, after a lot of struggle, accepted it and sent him to a place to get rehabilitated, and then they pursued the people who were pushing this stuff. It happened not to be at our school, but at a neighboring school. So there are cases where you cannot simply be confidential because it's dangerous and it's not good for the person. A person also may be so seriously incompetent that they become a public danger. The epileptic bus driver, for example, who refuses to change his job. There's a famous case called Tarasoff versus Regents of the University of California, where the court held that a therapist was responsible for not warning third parties that his client might be dangerous. This was some kind of murderer. And, you know, generally, of course, you come to a psychiatrist and you're assured of total confidentiality. But like the case of my guy with heroin, if you confess that you're a murderer, the most states decide that it is the responsibility of the therapist at least to work with the forces of order, if not to turn them in. Now, in all these cases, of course, the family or society has an obligation to prevent harm to the patient and the public, because all are members of this community, which I've been pushing for in the first half, and they exist for the good of each other. Professionals not only have the right, but also the duty to communicate and inform so that serious harm, not only to others, but to the patient, can be avoided, even when this is given to them in confidence. This is a tough one, because you have to determine that AIDS is a communicable disease, which it is and it isn't, because the way of communication is by doing acts that are immoral, whether taking injections or being unfaithful. So many people would feel that in this case, confidentiality is all right, but at the same time, you've got to educate the society to staying safe. Others would argue confidentiality has no place because this person is a risk. I lean towards saying we could keep confidentiality in most cases, not in all, but in most cases, because it seems to me that it's the way of getting HIV is a way that involves breaking a moral code, and that's something that you don't want anybody to do for any reason. If you go after the person with AIDS, you make them a special case of it, and then you say that they have to have their freedom removed, which in fact is not always necessary. In many, perhaps most professions, the fact of having HIV is not a danger to the profession, to the calling. Now, if the person has serious problems and goes around, you know, infecting others, that's of course different. But you know, there was a school in England which wrestled with this because they had a child who had HIV through a blood transfusion when the mother was pregnant. And at first the parents didn't want their children to go to the school and play with the child and so on. And then they came to an agreement that there was very little, if not minimal or no risk of getting the disease from the child. The only place it could happen would be like on the recess field, if he scratched himself and then he made contact with another child who scratched himself, and you know, so they set up things to avoid that. But they decided that, on the whole, the child should have that freedom, and they decided not to just tell all the parents, but they had the teachers know, and the teachers kind of guided the thing so that that child was never put in a situation where he might infect another. And I think that's probably good. If you begin to tell everybody, you begin to, then you can seriously, I think, impair the freedom and the rights of someone whose rights are not necessarily in question. This, of course, becomes a very different kind of matter when you're at the acute phases of it. And there are certain professions where you really don't want to have people with HIV. So it's a really tough one. How do you justify biblically what amounts to lying when you have decided that confidentiality is okay? Well, the ninth commandment proscribes false witness. But what is false witness? Some would distinguish between a falsehood, that is a false statement, and a lie. A lie is a statement that's false, but also one that is made to someone who has the right to know the truth. And you can think of biblical examples where this distinction, I think, is made. What about the case of Rahab, who hid the spies and then told a falsehood to the pursuants from the enemy? Now, some Christians, some ethicists believe that she was wrong to tell a falsehood. That when the book of Hebrews commends her, it's for her general faith, but not for the particular act of the falsehood. My view is that the falsehood was justified because in a wartime situation, people do not have the right to know the kind of answer that they were requiring of her.
Remember David going mad?
Right.
To go mad in order to get away.
Frothing at the mouth, yeah. And there is no no indication in the narrative that that was a bad thing to do. Now, the Bible doesn't always give an opinion, but it usually does. At least give a hint of the fact that this was not the right thing to do. In fact, in Psalm, is it 34, where David comments on his own experience, he said he praises the Lord for protecting him, and the midwives, you remember, in Egypt, were told by the Egyptians to kill the male children, and they wouldn't do it, and they made up some story like they came out so fast it was, you know, we couldn't handle it. I think this is a biblical principle that falsehood is sometimes justified because the person does not have the right to a true answer in some circumstances. War is a very classic one. Games is another. I mean, it'd be kind of stupid to watch a football game when, you know, and after the huddle, like they decide, well, I cannot tell a lie. I better go tell them my play. You know, this is so there are, and then this problem of confidentiality, of course, relates to professional secrecy. You, of course, when you are hearing someone's problems as a therapist or a minister, in most cases, you're hearing somebody's repentance or somebody's moral confession, confidences, revealing personal moral responsibility before God, and in that sense, it's beyond human judgment, it's not that it's something that has to be told or told about. And there are many cases where murders and crimes like that have been confessed, and it has not been prosecuted because there seemed to be no good reason to do so. Very serious problems about confidentiality have been raised recently by the fact that health records are computerized, and by the requirement of private and government health insurance plans that doctors report the nature of illness as a condition for getting paid. Now, a doctor does not have the right to give information without the patient's permission, but you still have the larger question of how are patients to obtain the benefits to which they're entitled without giving such permission? The insurance or public agency has the right to ask proof from patients that they have used funds for a legitimate medical purpose, but the agency also has the duty to design adequate controls which do not require a detailed account of the disease, even when permission is given. And care has to be taken to limit the availability of these records to a few definitely authorized persons. Some professionals argue for extreme individualistic or sort of libertarian position. Or they'll say that addicts should be permitted free access to alcohol and drugs, or there should be the freedom to any kind of behavior, and it, you know, and the idea that it's only harming yourself doesn't harm others. And this is was a frequently used argument in the 60s for things like marijuana. It doesn't harm anyone, it was said. And if it does harm anyone, it's myself. It's my own choice. I can do what I want. In fact, of course, it does harm others besides yourself, because we all live in community. We live in families who care about us. We live in a society which, in which, whether we want to or not, we're examples. We have to act in community. And so we are not free to decide to do what we want and then have it kept a secret. So I think this is a tricky matter. There are many circumstances in which you do want to maintain secrecy, but there are others where you just simply cannot, because you belong to society at large. Does anybody want to add anything about confidentiality? I didn't say very much about it. It's a big subject, actually.
When I was doing my research for my paper on organ transplants, I came across something very interesting, in that family members who have a match for transplant, they don't want to, for example, a kidney.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't want to give up one of their kidneys for a family member, ask the doctor to lie about their compatibility to the family, so there's no pressure put on them to donate. And a lot of doctors have a problem with that, because it's hard to say to the family, no, I have, you know, there's no one that matches the patient.
Well, it isn't
true. They know there is someone.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess my simplistic answer would be, why do they hide behind the doctor when they could just tell them themselves? Of course, I know it's embarrassing and difficult.
Well, there's incredible pressure.
Yeah.
Then
right.
He says, well, if you just do it, you would save their life.
Yeah. Yeah, that's tough.
There's a new case, is it
what do you think about the proposal of national health insurance? How would that affect? What do you project for that if that comes?
Well, I would agree with Jonathan Silley, who was here a few weeks ago, that it's going to happen. I think it's just a matter of time. But having lived in two societies and knowing a third quite well, where there is national health, I guess I have mixed feelings about it. Where I think it's justified is that there's a huge number of people today who simply aren't getting care. And one of the reasons for that has surely got to be that there is too much expense involved in getting a doctor and so on. And if national health has done a lot for older people through Medicare, Medicaid, it'll certainly do a lot for those people. My reservations are that in a couple of the places where we've lived, where there is a national health program, the level of care you get doesn't seem to me to be as high. In one of the places we lived, it was very high. In France, it was very high. And the fact of national health not only was not a detriment to, but was a promoting of high care because of the way it was structured. But I went to a couple of countries where it seemed to me we were always lining up in some room, and we would get some intern, and he'd do the best he can, or she would, and then you were finished. And it seems to me it's a healthier society that can have the freedom to go to a person of their choice. To be sure, in national health care, in most of the systems, you still can go to a person of choice, but it costs you incredible amounts. And like in France, if you go to a doctor that's outside of the system, you just won't be reimbursed, and so that's pretty prohibitive. In other societies, you're forced to go to your own sector as opposed to a neighboring sector, and that sounds right, but it doesn't have to be very helpful because the other sector might be better than yours. So I have mixed feelings about it. I think in any case, it is not a panacea. It's going to be a political thing. It's going to sound great, and you can, you know, like Wofford, he campaigned on this basis, and he was giving all these cases of poor people who couldn't get care, and I mean, it's pretty hard to argue against that. It's going to come, and it just will not be a big panacea. We'll just have another set of problems, more bureaucracy, more stuff, and you know, we'll have to muddle along.
Well, we've been talking about rights of privacy. My fear with national health insurance is that, coupled with the computerization of information, much medical information about patients will become readily available across the country, especially to investigators who will use it for data processing, I mean, publishing papers. This brings up a question, which is that of the economic side of this, which is to say that perhaps the poor people will not care if they go to see anybody on the national plan because they need to have their child taken care of, and so on. And so the information gets put in somewhere, into some data bank, et cetera. But as one goes up the ladder of economic wealth, one will find more pressure towards individualization, and that in effect then thrusts aside this more socializing tendency. Now, how about that economic side? Is there an economic critique, source of critique, that we can make of these things, other than just the obvious of money? We're not talking just about money. We're talking about the stratification of society along a triangle, as it were, with national health insurance at the bottom. And what will happen is the utilization of at the bottom of several layers for fodder, shall I say, a kind of an economic factor, a grouping together of different sorts of factors for the sake of, let's say, the medical profession, which will lose money on the one hand, in one sense, because the cost of hospitalization, et cetera, will go down, or at least be regulated, but will retaliate on the other side by getting data on people and using it for experimentation, et cetera, and this and that. So you see, there's a dialectic in here. Mm-hmm. This is not a Marxist argument. Mm-hmm. There is a dialectic in this.
Yeah. Well, in France, there were very, very strict laws about confidentiality. And when research was done, you couldn't indiscriminately break into national health files. In fact, the files were kept in regions and were themselves heavily protected. Now, you could, of course, do data studies of certain epidemics, you know, and you could do all kinds of stuff like that, but you couldn't do any kind of study that would violate the privacy of a person. You couldn't connect a name, for example. I mean, that's an obvious case. You can't connect a name with a particular disease. And you could do nothing that would in any way help somebody to isolate a type or a person or a a community or a class or whatever. It was, you know, so I assume that if you think about this, if you think this carefully through, it can be done so that you're not violating people's rights. Whether it's going to happen that way is another question. And even, so that's one thing. The thing about saving money, yes, I guess it probably does save money in a way. But it's hard to know whether it really saves money in the long run, because what happens is that the expenses are roughly the same. You know, you run a hospital, you produce medicine, you basically have X expenses. How's it going to be met? Well, if it's not being met by the patient, it's being met by taxes. And so, though you may not notice it as well, you're simply paying more for all of life. And again, to use the example of France, we were taxed on everything. And the Social Security tax, which is what the national health was there, was among the highest. And you know, to the extent that some people seriously argued that incentive was removed to do business and to start new enterprises and things like that. Others would argue that it was a necessary part of responsibility. But in fact, I don't think it does save money. It simply redistributes the money, and the expenses are the same. It's just paying for it is a little different. And we saw in France, one of the things that happened, and I think they're trying to work on this, but one of the things that happened is that there's a certain type of person, because it doesn't cost much, who shows up in the doctor's office all the time. And this type of person is usually in the lower economic brackets, not always. There were some other cases, but you know, this was something out of fear or ignorance or dependency or whatever it is, but or needing attention. But people would just go and show up, and because it hardly cost anything, there's no deterrent from doing this. Now they have tried to give some deterrent. One of the things they do is, you'll have to pay a certain percent, and then if it's the second, third, fourth, or fifth visit or whatever, your percent may increase depending on certain factors. So it does become expensive to show up for no reason, you know, and they've tried to regulate that. Another thing they've built into it is that Social Security will reimburse this amount. And they've got every single disease and type of visit and specialist and operations that categorize. And they'll give this amount. And then if the doctor wants to charge over and above it, that's fine. But he's going to lose patients if the guy down the street charges less or charges what the Social Security gives. But it does put the doctors in somewhat of a bind, because they are not, in every case, making a lot of money. That may be good or bad. It's probably bad in that you want such a high profession to have some incentive, and in a fallen world, unfortunately, money is one of them. So there are a lot of different factors there.
Bill, can I just get one another sort of thing, which is, shall we say, not macroscopic, but microscopic. I had some ophthalmologic problems a couple of years ago. I went down to a clinic at the University of Pennsylvania, and the studies would have been completely free, paid for by NIMH, since it went home, or NIH, one of the two. And what I reneged on it before went it because of the fact that even though, shall we say, this was a form of national health insurance, in which I would have been diagnosed a certain way and with the most precise instruments, I would have had to wear contact lenses, which were tinted a certain way, according to other sorts of instruments, so that my brain itself would have been red inwardly, and so that the coordination and, shall we say, activity of the eyes would have been studied from inside the brain itself. Now, if we're talking about privacy here, I would have been private in the sense that all results in my case would have been not mentioned by name in the publication of this researcher. But my privacy in another sense would have been completely demolished in the fact that my innards had been exposed and possibly set up photographed on one of the pages of the article or perhaps another sort of way. So there are very many different types of privacy here. I find it rather interesting that, if it's a question of an individual person's privacy, by name is one thing, but there are other types of privacy.
Well, yeah, there I would say if the experiment is invading the rights of the person, you have another kind of problem. I mean, the problem of confidentiality and privacy is one thing, but the abuse of individual integrity by experiments which are questionable is another. And I mean, we have laws against this kind of thing. I don't know what the people down there were doing about those laws, but there's
forgetting.
Yeah, well, but I mean, that's another order of a. It's something like, you know, like we have, there's animal rights, you know, and people, there's laws protecting animals. Now people abuse those laws all the time, and the argument is often, well, but we can learn so much; it'll save human beings. And there's some truth to that, but there's a point at which your virtuous society recognizes the place and quote dignity of even an animal, so that you can't do certain things no matter what the end might be. And that I think is a danger in a society that's very, very technical. My roommate in college was in the psychology department. And he regularly saw, now they don't do this anymore, partly because he and other people objected, but he regularly saw, you know, using curare and other drugs that would numb or paralyze an animal, but not desensitize the animal. And it's just, whatever good may have come out of it, it was cruel. And they put a stop to it, and that's one of the risks of a highly technical society. But it's something that you need to be active in fighting against when it is indeed the invasion of someone's privacy and someone's integrity. Just like doing experiments on tissue from embryos. You know, if you need to produce an embryo to get the tissue, and that is a risk to the life of the embryo, no matter what good it is to society, it's something that we don't do to unborn children. Of course, then you have to argue further, what happens if they've been aborted? Is that okay? Well, I think that's a double problem, not rather than a simple one. But, I think we need to have strictures against that kind of thing. There's a lot more on that I could say about confidentiality and so on. We ought to get some discussion going on the reading we did for this week. It's all related, of course. The additional question that is being raised by the chapters we read here, and this is something also related to your question, is what are the issues involved in the kind of behavior control that can be found not only in traditional medicine, but in psychotherapy? And again, things are not terribly clear because rights of privacy are involved, but also the definition of care that is characteristic of the type of therapy that involves behavior control is in much dispute. So they, of course, have articles from various points of view. It is mentioned in one of them that someone like Thomas Szasz, for example, believes that it's wrong to consider any mental disorder as an illness unless it's precisely an organic disorder. In other words, unless you've got a tumor or a chemical imbalance or an endocrine problem or something like that, then you shouldn't call it illness. It is simply a behavioral or moral disorder. And then you have others who would lump every kind of psychological problem under illness. And then you have still others who would be the strict behaviorists who would go along with Szasz to the extent that you wouldn't call it an illness, but who would say that it's nevertheless a serious enough disorder so that a therapy-like procedure should be engaged in, and some of it is very radical behavior control. There is a very famous behavioral therapist called Wolff, W-O-L-F-F, who has found a cure for homosexuality by taking a patient and showing pictures, if it's a male, of a nude man, and then giving him an electric shock, and then of a nude lady, and no electric shock or even reward, you do this over and over again. It's the Clockwork Orange kind of thing. You begin to modify someone's behavior, and you know, the question here, I guess, is twofold. First of all, what does it do to the rights of a person who is a moral unit to have behavior modified through such strictly Skinnerian approaches in a civil society? And second, as a Christian, what do we say about the, as it were, freedom of a person to rebel against God? Now, I don't mean this in the Arminian sense. I don't mean that God sort of gave us lots of robe and leeway. But there is something of the integrity of a person who may have made the wrong choice is still kept in a fallen world by God's patience and common grace. And when God comes and calls us to repentance, he doesn't come with behavioristic modification in order to set us straight. So those questions are really very important ones in the way that some medical therapies are going, and not just medical, but you know, behavioristic and so on. And they also raised the question we raised during the first hour of the dependency, the authority structure of the therapist and the patient. And I think my general answer would be the same as what we said in the first hour, and that is that if we see ourselves as a community and we see doctors and psychotherapists as being teachers of virtue whose techniques and art permit and foster the health and relative good, because it's always fragile and not fallible, of a society and of an individual, you can have an answer to these problems. However, you need to go the step further and say, well, what is the good in this case? And we have to, I think, as Christians, make decisions about the propriety of certain types of therapies, which involve not only behavior modification, but involve a theory of personality, a theory of man, which may be out of whack with the Bible. I know that Westminster is famous because Jay Adams, in the late 60s and early 70s, came up with a very, very radical theory that since sin is at the root of every ill, only in very limited cases would you ever use drug therapy. And I think he rather went along with Thomas Szasz's general notion that there was no category of mental illness other than endocrine deficiency or whatever it might be. I think I do not go as far as he does. I'm as suspicious of overusing drugs for therapy as anyone, but I think I am much more favorable to psychiatry than I understand him to be.